Not many years ago, suicide was viewed in public opinion as something disgraceful, unmentionable, and cowardly. In the last couple of decades, of course, things are changing. The view is changing, and they're changing rapidly. I want you to think about a passage that is seemingly unrelated to this. This is dealing with a completely different context. Matthew 24, verse 10 through 12, Jesus is talking about what's going to happen prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. But he says some significant things about how things deteriorate in a society, in this case, the Jewish society. And he says of that, that there will be a loss of faith among believers, that people will betray one another, they'll hate one another, people will be misled by false teachers and false prophets, false Christs, and that there will be increasing lawlessness and that human love itself will grow cold. This is what we're seeing actually today in our society. We're seeing these same things happening today. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to see a destruction of the United States in the near future, necessarily. But it does mean that the same factors that are present then are now being present in our society. And it's not a good thing. This is not a positive thing. And this is not a neutral thing either. Add to all that an increase in personal freedoms, the worship of self, humanistic thinking. And then at the same time, we see a decrease in spiritual values, a genuine belief in God, and moral truth, which is the grounding, the foundation of our spiritual well-being. So what you're seeing then is you're seeing all kinds of external things as well as internal things that are compromising people's ability to cope with life. And those without any spiritual grounding in divine truth, when they're faced with such pressures and such situations, they lose hope, they grow hopeless, they fall into despair, and the best thing for them to do, in some people's opinion, is to end their lives. The best thing to do, according to Right to Die advocates, is to kill yourself. This is a quote from one of them. He says, "We consider it a right for all rational adults to be able to divest themselves of their life." Well, that might sound intriguing on paper. Of course, it can also be a very messy situation. We've had a number of celebrities in the last several years who have committed suicide, and they make the headlines because of their celebrity status. Recently, Chelsea Christ, who was 2019 Miss America, jumped off a 29-story apartment building. That had to have been a very ghastly sight there down on the sidewalk. So it's not a pretty thing. Sounds good on paper, but it doesn't turn out well. It turns out very awful. And in response to that, a couple years ago, Australian suicide advocate Philip Nitschke developed what he called the Sarco suicide pod. And this is, in his words, a life-extinguishing machine. And I quote, "a 3D printable portable coffin-like capsule with windows that can be transported to a tranquil place for a person's final moments of life," end quote. And the way this works is that it fills with nitrogen gas, which painlessly puts you to sleep, and then the person dies as a result of oxygen deprivation. And he says of his invention that this is a stylish and elegant way to die. And that death should not be, quote, "shrouded in by misery and gloom," end quote, but be a moment of celebration. Not only has he made suicide easy, he's even made it fashionable. And that's what we're seeing today, is that it's a fashionable way to die. You know, to die on your own terms seems very liberating and independent, self-asserting. And in some cases, it's a good way to get back at all the people that did you wrong, right? Suicide out of spite, in sort of, if you think about that. So here we are going forward, and we've got some legislative issues, and we've got people just kind of accepting, growing warm to the idea of suicide. And we need to back way up all of a sudden here and say, wait a minute, do we even have a right to suicide in the first place? Obviously, anyone can kill themselves. That's not the question. But a right is not about the ability that can be done, but rather the legitimacy for it. Can it legally and even morally be done? So really what we're talking about is a question of authority. All religious issues, all issues of moral context or morality always boil down to authority. We have to have authority to do what we're doing or to say what we're saying. As I mentioned, the HB 1141 bill in Washington right now gives physicians increased permission for doctor-assisted suicide. I actually responded to that bill in writing, and I basically gave a three-sentence response, which is this lesson in three sentences. You're probably thinking, why didn't you just give that to us, right? But I want you to give the full story here. And my point was, suicide is a moral issue and not a legislative issue. You are legislating on something you don't even fully understand and have no right to step into that arena, basically what I said. If we are the product of evolution, then we can pluck our rights out of thin air and call it good, right? I mean, if we just evolve from space dust, there's no point here. Because if you just evolve from space dust or single cell organism or monkeys or whatever else you want to start give as your starting point there, and we don't have a soul, we don't have a real conscience, just a fictitious one, and we don't have a future. We just die and it just disappears. No problem with that. But if we are made by a creator who is higher in nature and authority than us, then we need him to define any so-called rights that have to do with our lives, and especially with our ending our life. Otherwise, we are guilty of defying that creator. And I do know that it's increasingly acceptable and fashionable now to discard God and his laws, his revealed truth, but that doesn't make those things go away. And that's something that we want to take to heart here. All right, so first of all, some definitions that you have these on your page. By the way, I just threw all my notes in your worksheet there. I know I usually go an hour a page, so we're going to be a couple hours. If Paul can preach till midnight, I can preach till 8 o'clock. It's my thinking, right? Okay, it won't take that long. But suicide comes from a Latin word, a compound word, sui or sui, if you want, which means oneself, and then sidium, which means killing. So it's literally the killing of oneself, dying at one's own hand per that person's own intention. The method doesn't matter. That's not the point. It's only the act itself that is under consideration here. Euthanasia comes up in this discussion because that's in this House bill that's before Washington Senate right now. That's what this is really about, is euthanasia. That word literally means good death. It's a Greek word that means good death. And here we have someone other than the person dying who is involved, either actively by causing it or passively by removing or withholding life-saving support or life support. Which gets to the next one. What is life support? Well, any artificial means of postponing death would be considered life support. It's an artificial means. Until recently, this did not even exist. 100 years ago, we didn't have any life support systems. Now we have all kinds of life support systems, and that's created a lot of moral and ethical questions about, well, life support. In euthanasia, the removal of life support does not involve someone who has lost all ability to make decisions, like someone who is brain dead, like what Honey and I faced with her mom when we had to decide what to do with her when she was literally brain dead. That's a different scenario altogether, but rather this is someone who is the one wanting to die has stated his permission for someone else to help him die. That's what euthanasia is all about, active euthanasia. Incidentally, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. 50,000 people a year do take their own lives in the United States. Worldwide, that's 700,000 people a year. That's the 4th leading cause of death among 15 to 19-year-olds. The rate is twice as high for men than women. The highest risk is white middle-aged men. So I don't know if I'm still in middle age, but I think I just cleared the risk factor there. But that's a really frightening thing, and these are frightening statistics here. So central to the question of suicide that is often completely sidestepped in the national dialogue is this idea of right. Do we have a right to die? Do people have a right to take their own lives? Or in the case of euthanasia, do we have a right to help someone end their life? Or do we even have the right to the permission to be given to us to help them end their life? There's a lot of assumptions here. It's like we've bypass the assumption, or we're acting on the assumptions rather, right? Bypassing the big questions and then moving on. By the way, for what it's worth, the same style of argument is used in regard to abortion. The people have said, the authorities, if you will, the scientific and medical authorities have said they're not sure when life begins, but they're going to okay abortion anyway. So you sidestep the real science or the real moral crux of the matter, and you just go on to what you consider a right. So what is a right? Well, a right is an entitlement. It is a privilege. It is a legally granted authority to act. Technically and legally speaking, it is not an opinion. It is not a desire. It is not a self-determined conclusion, because a right in this context always requires a higher authority to define it and to validate it. So you don't have a right to something unless someone higher than you has given you that right, qualified that right, or entitled you with that right by their higher authority. No one has the right to do anything unless they are given that or endowed that right by a higher authority than himself. You think about American citizenship, for example, and our entitlements. We do have rights. The first section after the actual Constitution is called the Bill of Rights. It's the first 10 amendments of the Constitution. And those rights are permissions as well as protections for American citizenship, which is fine. We have the legal authority to do that because we're dealing right across the board. We have a legal authority by men, given to men over things that govern men. We're still within a kind of an equal platform, if you will, of entitlement here. Or we can appeal to a higher authority, in essence, a law for all of humankind. Well, now we have to go above the Constitution because now we're dealing with people outside of the United States. And so now that we do that, we go to someone higher than any state or any entity or any government, and we go to the Creator, the giver of life. When those two things are in conflict, say the law of man and the law of God, we always defer to, ideally, the law of God because he's greater in authority. If you remember the lesson this morning, what did we say? Well, what did Peter say? Acts 5:29, we must obey God rather than men. And there's a reason for that, because God has a greater authority than any person has, or even any body of people has. At some point, law itself has to be defined and understood, because what I'm saying in all this is I cannot create a law for all of humankind, and you can't either. In fact, we can't do that because we don't have the authority or the power to enforce that law. First of all, we don't have the power to make it. We don't have the power to enforce it. But neither does anyone else, because we're all equal in nature. We all have the same limitations. What I'm saying in the basic sense is you can't make laws that exceed our authority to make laws. You can't use an authority you don't have in order to become an authority, if that makes any sense. But that's exactly what's happening right now in some of these moral issues that we're being faced with. Think about this right to abortion that I mentioned earlier, the idea that we can terminate human life in the womb. This right is not granted by the Constitution. This right is not granted by transcendent authority either. In other words, God didn't give us this right. So that begs the question, where is that right coming from? And it really comes down to individuals acting on their own authority, but with an authority they don't have to act upon. They're plucking an authority out of thin air and then saying, we have the right to do this. And whether that authority is an individual person who wants to do something or a legislative body that seemingly gives permission for someone to do something, it doesn't matter. It's still an illegitimate authority. We don't have that kind of authority. We don't have authority to prescribes what to do about human life itself. Another one that we're being faced with now is you have the right to choose your own gender. Well, that's not in the Constitution. And that's not even according to science, even though everyone's always about, you know, follow the science, except in this case, don't follow the science, follow your heart, right? And so it just doesn't make any sense there. But we're told science is never wrong, except, of course, in this case. Now it is wrong. There is no higher or transcendent authority to allow us to choose our own gender. So where does this authority come from? It comes from our own selves. We are the ones who are deciding, without any authority of our own, that is legitimate authority to do so, we're deciding what can be done, even though we don't have authority to make the decision. And so you see what's happening here. We have this huge conundrum where we're trying to do things by a power that we don't really have. We're trying to say things with an authority that we really don't have. But then we're coming up with conclusions that need to be defended and enacted, and that just doesn't make any sense. Here's another one to consider that goes in the other direction, a right to a fair trial. Well, you do have a right to a fair trial. You actually have constitutional authority for that. I don't know if you knew that or not, but you do. Okay? You have constitutional backing there. You can even argue that from Scripture, that you have a right to a fair trial. Remember, everything must be confirmed by two or three witnesses. That's basically a fair trial. Unfortunately, many are denied this right, which is constitutionally and even biblically supported. They're denied this right by those who have no right to deny the right. So you kind of see it in the other way here, where we do have a right, but now we're having this right taken away. So in the first couple cases, we have rights that are just being plucked out of thin air and then being upheld somehow. And then when we do have a right, that right's taken away. One thing we're gathering from this already is that people are fickle and inconsistent and often hypocritical. That brings us to this point here. What is the highest authority? We've already said that the highest authority would be our Creator, the one who brought us into existence and gave us consciousness, and in doing so gave us an eternal soul. He has full authority over everyone here and everyone out there and everyone who is existing on the planet and everyone who has ever existed on the planet. Now we're talking about real authority and real power. He is higher in nature than us, therefore not limited to our, well, limitations, our constraints. He's outside of time. He's outside of the three-dimensional world. He's outside of human circumstances. There's nothing that can bind him to what we're bound by. He stands as lawgiver and judge over all of us. This is the clear an unapologetic position of Scripture. Human beings are made in the image of God. You can see that in Genesis 1:27 in the creation account. That is restated in Genesis 5, verse 1. This cannot be said of plants or fish or birds or animals. This is why we can put a dog to sleep without committing a moral crime. Because a dog is a lower form of life and is lower nature than ourselves, so we have authority over dogs, so to speak. But a human being made in an image higher than ourselves, if we're going to do anything to that image, we need the permission of the one higher than ourselves to do that, to take action. We need the one possessing a higher nature in order to carry that out. And I know what someone's going to say, because it's already been said in, again, the national dialogue or narrative on this subject. I don't believe in God, so it's a pointless argument. It's not true at all. The argument still stands because the facts and the evidence supporting it does not require 100% support or consensus in order for it to be so. God's existence doesn't need everyone to agree that he exists in order for him to exist. And if everyone got together and said, you know what, we've all decided that God doesn't exist, can we see a show of hands and everyone raises their hand, do you think God just poofs out of existence because we said so? We don't have authority to make him not exist. Unbelievers don't change the facts. Someone says, well, I don't believe in science. Well, that doesn't change the facts of science. Someone says, I don't believe in natural laws, but the laws are still there, regardless. Someone says, well, I don't believe in the existence of the sun. Well, that doesn't change anything because the sun's still there, right? You don't have to believe in something in order for it to be true. It's true not because of your belief in it, it's true because of the facts and the evidence that support that truth in the first place. So, when someone says, well, I don't believe in God, okay, you have the right, because it's a God-given right to not believe in him if you want to, but that doesn't change the situation one bit. Personal opinions, convictions, beliefs, these do not change the absolute truths or laws that are out of reach of human interference. Because there are laws that are out of our reach. So we say, since God exists, and if he did give us a right to end our own life, he would have told us this in his revealed word. And secondly, we could cite that word as an authoritative reason for what we're doing. And then thirdly, there would be no consequence, no shame, no guilt, no expectation of judgment, no consequence or punishment in the world to come. If that were true, if he did do that, but he doesn't do that. In fact, the Bible actually takes us in the opposite direction of all of this. You can't pluck rights out of thin air and then implement them without permission or without authority. This is illegitimate and unwarranted to do so. And yet the right to die or right to suicide advocates are doing exactly that. They are offering arguments, but they are really not arguments at all. In reality, they are just opinions. They're offering their opinions as though they were arguments. They are not the same thing. An opinion is not an argument. An opinion is what you choose to believe. An argument is based on facts and evidence outside of yourself that you don't even necessarily control, but you can cite them as proof of what you're saying is true. The argument, and I'm using their word here, really opinion, is if someone has lost all quality of life, then it is practical that they end their life. Or if someone is tired of life because they're old and they feel like they can no longer contribute to society, or because they are suffering, perhaps with some terminal disease, then it is compassionate to end their life, for them to end their life, that is. In other words, if death is inevitable, then to speed up the process is permissible. Of course, my question is, well, why stop there? Why have to have a terminal disease? Or why have to have any reason? I mean, isn't death inevitable for everybody? So why are we waiting for certain circumstances to happen before we decide that, well, death is inevitable, so we can just end it all? Who's making that decision? Where are these decisions coming from? Again, these are all opinions. So there's a practicality issue, and then there's a compassion issue. Sometimes they're intertwined with each other. The problem, and it's a huge problem, is that these two things themselves are subjectively defined. And what I mean by that is there is no objective or outside of ourself, transcendent, universal authority being cited. It's just one's feeling about that, or one's say-so, like of the supporters of right to die or right to suicide advocates. And thus, really, it's resting on human authority alone. Remember, we're dealing with a realm here, human life, that is greater than we have permission to legislate on. And yet, the opinion is that we can do it anyway. We don't have the authority, but we can do it anyway. Why? Because it's practical and it's compassionate. Those are opinions, not necessarily universal facts. So, invoking the practical slash compassionate justification, people are not really given the right to end their life. Because if they were given that right, then we say, well, where'd that come from? Who gave you that? What authority? And so on. But rather, they have assumed the right to do so. And even if we make it a law on the books, even if we change the Constitution, we're still dealing with a realm of authority that is greater than the Constitution has the right to legislate. We're still dealing with that higher realm. And I know what people are going to say, because it's always said, what about the suffering issue? And that's a lesson really unto itself. I mean, whole books have been written on this. This is a moral issue that people really do struggle with. The modern American mindset, for what it is worth, is basically this, that all suffering is bad, all suffering is wrong, all suffering must be avoided at all costs. Thus, it is better to die or to take your own life than to have to suffer what they would say is needlessly. This is a very humanistic mindset. The idea promoted there is that you are only worth something if you are fully functional, capable, and, well, for better lack of a better term, normal. And then, of course, that mindset defines what all those things are. And if you fall from that, then, well, your life becomes expendable. By the way, this is not a new idea. This has been around for a long time. Back in Jesus' day, there was this thing called Stoicism, which is still being practiced today. And the Stoics believe that if you're usefulness to society has run out, then it is not just permissible, but actually the right thing to do, as they saw it, to end your life. And a lot of people did on that basis. The thing is that suffering itself, like pain itself, is also highly subjective. Two people can face the same situation but suffer it differently. Men suffer differently than women do. Different people in different cultures suffer differently than, well, other cultures. There are many factors that play into the suffering context here. Ultimately, it becomes a personal assessment. I've had to deal with this personally lately. Some of you know I had some neck issues, which was causing excruciating pain in my shoulder and my left arm. And when you go into the doctor's office, they have this little chart, and it says, you know, can you numerate your suffering 1 to 10, right? Have you ever seen that? It's a scale. And so you're trying to tell your doctor, well, I'm a 6 or I'm a 7, because I was hitting, I think, in my opinion, a 9 a few times there, right? But you realize that it's not the doctor assessing you, it's you assessing yourself. The doctor may have created the scale, but you're the one telling him where you're at on the scale. And so it becomes very subjective. Someone hurts a little bit, maybe they got a toothache, and I've had those can be painful, you know, or a broken bone or something like that, and they're like shooting all the way to 10, right? I had one of my relatives, I was with, that's my mom. Okay, so I was with my mom, and she was in the doctor's office. She said, scale 1 to 10, she says, I'm at a 12. It's like, you're not even on the scale. At least abide by the rules, right? So, but my point with all this is that it's very subjective. We are basing these things on what people who are going through it are telling us. And this is true all the time. This is why it's very hard to objectively determine what suffering really is. Presently, in reaction to COVID, and I say presently like in the last 2 years, fear of suffering, if you think about it, the fear of suffering, even something like cold and flu symptoms, which, you know, a lot of us have weathered in the past and we all lived through it and, you know, it wasn't fun, but, you know, we survived. But that fear was so strong and continues to be so strong among some that many Americans are willing to give up their constitutional rights in order to avoid that suffering. That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, from a citizenship point of view, that doesn't make any sense. And instead, they're allowing the government to take responsibility for their health and safety. Also, something that we should never have given to the government to do. What the government ought to do is protect our constitutional rights, not tell us how to wash our hands or wear a mask. And all that despite 99% rate of survival. This is what happens when fear of suffering enters into the equation, because people don't want to suffer. Remember my earlier point. The assumption is suffering is bad, must be avoided at all costs. So if there's a potential for suffering, we need to do everything we can to avoid that. That's where the American mindset is in general right now. It's a frightening thing because now we're not guided by patriotism or constitutionality or what's in the best interest of the nation. Now we're all being led by fear. Fear of suffering, which may or may not even happen to us. And yet, here's the other side of that. Suffering can provide positive change of heart, change of outlook, change of faith, and even change of eternity. God does not advocate suffering needlessly. Even though life may bring that upon us, that's not something that God is advocating or promoting. But he does allow us and even calls us, us being Christians, to suffer for what is right and to suffer for what is in his name. God allowed his own people to suffer for their faith in him. Jesus promised that we would suffer for him if we followed him. And he endured suffering beyond anything that we can comprehend in himself. The Apostle Paul suffered immensely. Read 2 Corinthians chapter 11, starting about verse 22 down to the chapter, and you'll see a list of all kinds of suffering that makes COVID look like a cakewalk. In 2 Timothy 1:8, he actually has the audacity to tell Timothy, join with me in suffering for the gospel. Suffering isn't all bad. Suffering isn't always bad. The point here is that citing suffering as a justified for suicide may sound good up front, and it may gain supporters, but it is based on human opinions, and it's based on a very humanistic, not a godly, but a very humanistic outlook with no spiritual consideration. Now we get to the heart of the matter right here, the morality of the issue. In Exodus 20, verse 13, God said simply, you shall not murder. Now, I know someone might be saying, well, that's part of the Ten Commandments, and it is. And we're not under the Ten Commandments, which is true, technically. But these are moral laws. And moral laws are consistent with every covenant. So even though we're not under the Ten Commandments, per se, we are under any moral law in the Ten Commandments. And that includes this one. To murder is to actively kill someone, but the implication of that killing is by one's own authority. It is a selfish act versus a punishment for having forfeited the right to live. In Leviticus 24, verse 17, it says, if a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. Well, obviously implied in that context there is not just taking the life at all under any circumstances, but taking the life selfishly, murderously, for his own vengeance or whatever. This is God's authority to give us permission to put that man to death. Now think about the irony here. We're putting to death the one, legally putting to death the one who has illegally put to death someone else's life. One has authority, one does not. So God may put people to death or had Israel do the same as an extension of his justice, but none of that was murder because it was justified by the highest authority as a fitting consequence for sinful people. God called for the extermination of the Canaanites in Genesis 15, but he waited 400 years for them to come to their senses before he carried it out because he didn't want to go that route. He wanted them to repent instead. They didn't, so therefore they lost forfeited their right to live. There's a difference between murder and suicide, or difference between a murderer and one committing suicide. Even a murderer can repent and seek forgiveness before he is executed. It's interesting, I'm in 1 Timothy chapter 1 here, verse 9, where Paul talks about the law being good if one uses it lawfully, and then it says, realizing the fact that law is not made for a righteous person, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, and then he lists murderers in there. The law is made for murderers. In other words, to define murderers, but also to, in the case of the gospel, God's law, to bring those murderers out of a guilty situation. That doesn't mean that they still aren't to be put to death, but it means that they don't have to lose their soul. Suicide, on the other hand, offers no opportunity for repentance and allows, therefore, for no recourse. Once you kill yourself, well, there's no repenting to be done. There's no recourse. There is nothing to help you. The final act on earth of the one who commits suicide is really that of defiance and rebellion against the Creator who gave him life in the first place. In essence, it is him invoking his own authority as that of being greater than God's. There is the ultimate exaltation of human pride. God, I defy your authority, and so much so, watch me. I'm going to take my own life. That is a very precarious place to be. Genesis 9, verse 6, God said, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. And then he tells you why. For in the image of God he made man. I don't know about you, but that's a pretty convincing argument right there. If people are given the right to put murderers to death for having murdered someone, then God has the right to put the souls of murderers to death, murderers of their own lives. So we don't have the right to end a life, whether it's ours or someone else's, of someone who is made in God's image, unless, of course, God gives us that right. He's the only one capable of doing that. The bottom line here is that none of us had the right to begin our existence. This did not come from an authority of human origin. It didn't come from our parents. Our parents participated in procreation. I don't want to get into all that, okay? But they did not invent it either. And they did not give their children a human soul. That came from God, a higher authority. So life comes from God. Human soul comes from God. A human conscience comes from God. Those are things that are above us and beyond us. And since that is true, none of us have the right to deliberately end our own existence, because we have no higher authority than God to cite in the case of that. It becomes a very willful or selfish act that is done without that divine authority and in defiance of the sacredness of life. That doesn't mean we can't do it, because obviously it's happening 50,000 times a year in the United States. It means we don't have a right to do it. Suicide is, for all intents and purposes, a form of murder, which God condemns. It's the intentional shedding of blood for reasons other than what God allows. Now, having said all that, hold that thought, because now we're going to look at something else. It must be admitted that there may be factors involved that neither we, the observers of someone doing this, nor those committing the act, can fully know or understand. That does not undermine all that I just said. Rather, it is something else to consider in light of the situation. I'll explain what I mean. There are factors, for example, as you see in your notes there, I think they're in your notes, that people have to deal with, that cause them to think about suicide, severe depression, mental instability, unspeakable grief, extreme or chronic pain, extraordinary circumstances. Circumstances that exceeds a person's ability to deal with or know what to do. Sometimes people kill themselves for causes that they believe are right. In World War II, there was a thing called the kamikaze pilots among the Japanese. Kamikazes was a name given to those pilots who, when their plane was destroyed beyond salvaging of any kind, they just literally and deliberately flew their plane into, well, the battleships of the United States. And they didn't do this, in their minds, to commit suicide. They did this because of their cultural beliefs, and they did this because they were in an extreme situation, and this is very hard for us to understand, but it was not a selfish act. I'm not trying to defend it, but I'm telling you that it was done for a different reason than just simply putting a gun to one's head. In 9/11, the so-called 9/11, 2001, well, we have a couple of towers in New York City that are on fire, and there's people trapped in the floors above all that, and they're being faced with either being burned to death by this incineration or jump out of the window and maybe survive or at least escape being burned to death. That is a horrible situation to face. I hope none of us ever have to face that kind of decision there. Or any other similarly horrifying reality such as that. Terminal illness can impair a person's judgment to the point where they can consider doing something that anyone else would say is irrational, and even something that previously they themselves would never have done. This is a situation kind of like similar to, you know, Christians saying, well, you know, if someone ever put a gun to my head, you know, and asked me to deny the Lord, I wouldn't deny him. I would be faithful in that. Well, that's nice to say, or, you know, noble to say, but the fact is, you've never had a gun put to your head. So you don't know. You've never had a terminal disease, so you don't know. You've never been in a high-rise building where it's on fire and your option is burn to death or jump to death. You don't know what you would do. And I don't know what I would do either, quite frankly. Some of you don't know this. My brother, Tracy, committed suicide in 2003. So I've had firsthand dealing with this scenario. He believed that he had terminal pancreatic cancer, lost all hope, lost the will to live, didn't want to go through all that suffering, so he literally put a gun to his head and took his own life. I'm not trying to excuse him or any of these other people. I'm not trying to justify this. I'm not trying to preach anyone into heaven. I'm just admitting that there are things that we cannot know, but they are there nonetheless, and they do factor in. One thing I'm not doing, and I want to be really clear, I'm not giving permission for anyone to commit suicide under those circumstances. I don't have the right or the authority to do that. All I'm admitting is that there may be extreme or extraordinary situations that go well beyond just feeling like you've outlived your purpose, or you're tired of living, or you have old age. It's not my place, nor anyone else's, to outline what extreme or overwhelming looks like. If it does exist, then God knows what it is, and he will deal with it in his own way. But when it's all said and done, those who are facing such situations, we leave to God to judge. He knows exactly and accurately and completely what they have gone through and what they have faced. We do not, we never will, this side of life, know that information. But just because extraordinary circumstances do exist does not invalidate all the scriptures that we just cited with regard to the situation and all the appeals to transcendent legal authority to act. Similarly, there may be extraordinary circumstances preventing someone from being baptized. Maybe a person reads that he has to be baptized, he wants to be baptized, he's trying to be baptized, maybe he's en route to being baptized, and then he's killed. And we go, oh, he lost his soul. I don't know about that. Those are extreme circumstances. Let God take care of that. But even so, it doesn't invalidate all the teaching in the Bible that says you need to be baptized in order to be saved. We don't use hypotheticals to override clear and prescribed laws. Even if the hypotheticals become reality, we turn these over to the lawgiver to decide them because he has perfect authority, perfect knowledge, and perfect knowledge of all the facts there. And furthermore, and this is a big point, just because someone does face extraordinary circumstances that leads to their suicide, it doesn't mean their souls are pardoned because they face those extraordinary circumstances. Those people that jumped out of the buildings in 9/11, they're not saved just because they jumped out of a building under extraordinary circumstances. The only way that you can have your soul pardoned and to be saved is to be saved by the blood of Christ in obedience, your obedience to what the gospel teaches. And if you don't do that, then your soul's not going to be saved just because you were faced with some extraordinary event. The sermon title is, Do We Have a Right to Suicide? It's not, can it be done? Because obviously it can. And it's not, will laws allow us to do it? Because obviously they may. Rather, what we're doing is we're appealing to the highest authority, the highest law. And that law and that authority says consistently, no, it does we do not have the right, creating a suicide pod, as this Australian guy has done, to make suicide more appealing or comfortable or stylish or pain-free, doesn't diminish for a minute the importance and the weight of divine law. The biblical teaching is clear, it is timeless, it is unchanged, and it is universally applied. And if someone wishes to reject that biblical teaching, that's on them. It doesn't make the teaching go away. It only identifies that person as a rebel to his Creator, in defiance to his Creator. I'll show you. I'll take my own life. Where do you think that soul's going to go as soon as that's over with? Right before the Creator. The death of a human being happens, of course, but it's not something to celebrate. We should not celebrate death. Even Jesus' death, it was not something we celebrated in itself. We don't celebrate Jesus' actual death as much as we celebrate what his death brought about. The accomplishment of that death. Not to glorify death in itself. The purpose of this lesson is not to start a revolution or to rehabilitate society. I doubt hardly anyone's going to listen to me outside of this room. The modern trend in every context considered is departing almost fully from God's authority, biblical authority, and moral responsibility. We're seeing that. But the lesson here is to warn Christians not to succumb to this false, self-serving claim about rights and practicality and compassion that are all just plucked out of thin air, and then using those things as though they were divine truth or having the weight of divine truth, because they don't. The truth is, we are all created in God's image, and we have no right to destroy what is created in God's image unless we have God's permission to do so. That's the lesson in a nutshell. Regardless of what secular society says, we need to remember that the majority of society is filled with a bunch of godless and self-serving people and are largely ignorant of what God says. Do not let those people dictate for you or your thinking how things should be run in God's world. We cannot choose society at the expense of God's word. That is my lesson. I hope that it was educational and hopefully enlightening and hopefully persuasive. But that is the lesson for this evening. As I said, I'm not offering an invitation necessarily, but if anyone does want to come forward, of course, that would be appropriate. We're going to let Bob lead us in a song now, number 572.